Hello, everyone. Can you hear me back there? Yes? Can you hear me back there? Mm-hmm. No?
Oh, there you go.
Okay. Now can you hear me? Yes, I think probably so, because I've come here speaking in a dialect that you're just going to have to live with. It comes out naturally. And thank you for dimming the lights. Can you see the colors satisfactorily in that first image? See, people are nodding their heads. Okay. No one ever disputed that life on the land is demanding for those who choose to raise animals or till the soil. My wife and I live on this farm in Texas, and I can attest to the fact that there's no end of work always waiting to be done. Earlier in my life, I lived in a sod house, half dug out, on a ranch in the Texas Panhandle, spending two winters on the Great Plains in the soddy. From that experience of hauling every drop of water that I used, I know that it weighs 8 pounds to the gallon of water. This lesson is the one I would like for each one of you to take home. In fact, I'm passing around this gallon jug of water that I bought at a supermarket on the way here this afternoon. If you only learn the weight of water, 8 pounds to the gallon, my goal in coming here from Texas will be achieved.
Please pass it around.
My predecessors on the Baker Farm in Hill County, Texas, who included my great-grandparents and my grandfather, the one on the side with the fancy neckwear, moved into a one-room tenant shack that they later expanded, and they did little more than grub out an existence. They had a plow, a mule, and hose to raise their meager cash crop of cotton. They supplemented it with small amounts of corn for both themselves and their animals. In the spring, they prepared the cotton fields with the plow. Then, when the soil temperature reached warm enough to germinate the seeds, sometime around the 1st of April when the mesquite trees started to leaf out, my great-grandfather, one of the teenage boys, would follow a mule pulling a plow while he dropped cotton seed into the depression the implement made while he kicked soil over the seeds with his foot. Eventually, they got a one-row cotton planter. The use of the plow then was over. And for the rest of the season, the hoe became virtually the sole implement of agriculture on the Baker farm. You can tell this was not sophisticated farming. Once the seeds sprouted, the family went to the fields to chop cotton, meaning that they thinned the seedlings to one about every foot and a half. Almost endless weeding followed. Weeks of cutting out wild plants so the cotton wouldn't starve to death for moisture or soil nutrients. By the hottest days of the year in August, the long-awaited laying by time arrived, and the family could take off 2 or 3 weeks while the cotton fibers matured in the bowls. During this time, the men and boys did their obligatory road repair work for the county, and the family maybe attended a revival. The old-fashioned laying by time for the cotton plants, after all, is the reason why we still go to protracted gospel meetings during the heat of the summer in the South. It's the life cycle of the cotton plant. Did that jug make it all the way to the back? All right. How much does it weigh? Good for you. In the early fall, the whole family began dragging long canvas bags through the fields to fill them up with cotton fibers that they hand-pulled out of the dried bowls. Before the development of hybrid seeds, the cotton matured throughout the autumn and winter. This meant that the harvesting process continued from September until a killing frost. And where we live, that could even be in December. Though this was the story for the Baker family, the labor of farmers and stock raisers was just as arduous everywhere else on the Great Plains, from Hill County, Texas, all the way to the prairie provinces of Canada. The physical conditions varied, but the work was no lighter. Everywhere, rural people sought ways to lessen the demands on animal and human muscle power. Time and again, we've heard the stories of time and labor-saving devices being introduced to lessen the labor of families on the land. The innovations included well-known machines like tractors, planters, cultivators, reaping and mowing machines, riding implements of all kinds, threshing machines, combines, harvesters. The list goes on and on. But what about water? Do you remember how much it weighs? You're not going to get an A if you don't speak up. 8 pounds to the gallon. How much water did the typical farm family need? Unless you've had the experience of hauling water, you tend to underestimate how much that a family uses. And if you haven't hauled water, you also don't know how many times you can use that water over and over. The amount calculated in 1940 right here in Nebraska by the Dempster Mill Manufacturing Company in Beatrice was that if you were hauling water, each person consumed 4 to 6 gallons daily. Obviously, if you're hauling water, you're not bathing. But a human consumes 4 to 6 gallons a day. Each horse, mule, or cow would drink 10 to 12 gallons of water. Each sheep or hog, 1 gallon apiece a day. And 100 chickens, 3 to 5 gallons of water for 100 chickens. Think about how much that gallon of water weighed that you passed around. And then multiply it by 10 or 12 for each horse or mule that you had. math for the rest of that farmstead. And this is just hauling water that was already at the surface. On the Great Plains, where did our water come from? If a person were incredibly lucky, he or she would have a free-flowing stream or spring that provided water close to the house. But how common was this? It probably would be safe to assume that fewer than 1% of the people on the Great Plains had such remarkable convenience. Everybody else either had to dig or drill a well or to haul water from a neighbor's source. Virtually all of this water came from underground. The depth of the water-bearing aquifer could vary from only 20 or 30 feet in an alluvial valley to several hundred feet. On the Baker farm, water could be found at 130 feet. In much of the Southwest, 500 feet or deeper was the norm. Since the technology of well drilling is its own separate story, let's think not about sinking wells, but rather just about hand pumping it from wells once they've been created. A piston displacement pump of the type used in most drilled wells on the Great Plains is a simple device with two valves. One valve is attached to the bottom of a cylindrical chamber, and the other is located in a plunger that moves up and down inside the chamber. This plunger connects by way of pump rods, traditionally made from 20-foot sections of ash wood attached to each other with wrought iron connectors, with a pump on the surface. This device frequently was a lever-action hand pump actuated by human muscle power. When one pushed down on the pump handle, the connecting pump rods pull the plunger up with the effect of pushing 6 inches, 8, 10, maybe 12 inches of water up the pipe. The pump pushes the water up the pipe. It doesn't suck it up, except on a little shallow pitcher pump, it pushes it up from the bottom. When the operator, often a teenage boy, drew the handle upward, this forced the plunger downward while opening its valve and positioned more water to be pushed upward. Each time the operator moved the pump handle up and down, he effectively pushed another 6, 8, 10, 12 inches of water up the pipe from the bottom. Eventually, it reached the surface and came out of a spout to fill a trough for a bucket. At 8 pounds to the gallon, this column of water was heavy, really heavy. And the chore of hand pumping water constituted truly arduous labor. If the farmer or stock raiser could afford to buy a windmill and mount it atop a tower, the wind machine's ironwork converted the spinning motion of the wheel into a reciprocating stroke to actuate the rods and the piston pump underground at the water table. Through this means, the power of the wind took the place of human muscle power, moving the pump rods and pushed the water up the pipe to the surface. Because the mechanism worked whenever the wind blew, this meant that it can elevate any surplus to be used when the wind was calm. It still remained for people to find ways to move the water to wherever it was wanted on the surface at the farm or ranch. Most consumers tried to use windmills in connection with gravity to accomplish this human work. Many agriculturists constructed elevated reservoirs to hold water so that it could be conveyed by pipes by the force of gravity to wherever it was needed. Frequently, this elevated tank stood atop an adjacent substructure. If a well happened to be near a hill, the consumer might add a device called a stuffing box so that the pump would not only push the water up the pipe to the surface, but even farther upward to the tank atop the hill or another elevated point, like a reservoir in the loft of a barn or in the attic of a house. In these instances, pipes then carried the water wherever it was needed within a reasonable distance, and faucets controlled the flow. Because today's talk deals with windmills and the mechanization of rural life, it's important for us to explore how these wind machines originated. Where did they come from? How did they become such ubiquitous visual elements in the Great Plains? How has their design and construction changed over time? What's been their tangible legacy on the land? Windmills for pumping water began appearing on the eastern fringe of the Great Plains in the 1860s. But within a decade, their use was becoming comparatively common in the heart of the region. The Dodge City Times, in a front page article in spring 1879, described how, in the editor's words, the windmill dots the prairies of Kansas, continuing to declare, it has become an indispensable part of the farm and stock range. The windmill manufacturing industry continued to grow through the 1880s and 90s, reaching its heyday by the turn of the 20th century. Turbine-type windmills of North America had their origin in New England. There, a mechanic by the name of Daniel Halliday in 1854 invented and patented the first commercially successful self-governing American windmill. The key term is self-governing. For Halliday's invention was able to turn to face changing wind directions without human assistance and was able to control its own speed of operation automatically to prevent its destruction from centrifugal force during high winds. In other words, to keep it from turning so fast that it self-destructed. Although they were first manufactured in Connecticut in the mid-1850s, the production of the machine shifted to Illinois in 1863 in order to be closer to the market that had grown for the windmills on the plains and prairies. How Halliday's mill represents one of the two major classes of 19th century American windmills, for its wheel soon came to be composed of a series of pivoted sections of blades that could swing away from the wind in governing to slow operating speeds during high winds. The other major design of North American windmill was what was called solid wheel, because its wheel was rigid and did not fold in. It's epitomized by the Eclipse windmill, one of the early competitors with Halliday's sectional wheel pattern. Developed in 1867, the Eclipse governed through the use of a second vane mounted parallel with the wheel, which pushed the wheel obliquely out of increasing wind velocities to control its speed. While a principal vane, which was hinged, remained parallel with the wind. The Eclipse was manufactured from the 1860s to the 1930s and became one of the most common windmills of the Great Plains. Before proceeding, it's necessary to address some questions of terminology. In common parlance, the expression windmill frequently is used to refer to a complete installation of a windmill and tower over a well. Strictly speaking, windmills are the machines mounted atop towers for the purpose of converting the wind into usable power. Towers are usually considered to be distinct from windmills, and they constitute the derricks which support windmills in the air. Adjacent to the windmills and towers, there may be ground level or elevated tanks, which themselves are discrete components of the larger water systems. For most observers, windmills and their towers were things of beauty. Perhaps these views were colored by the enormous labor of hand pumping water which they saved. The broad range of windmill models used on the plains in the early years typically were built from wood with certain iron and steel parts, and they were painted decoratively, much like farm tractors today. The following views alternate between historic photographs of windmills, all in Nebraska, all photographed by Solomon D. Butcher in the 1880s to 1900s. And I've paired them with views of restored examples of the same models showing their approximate appearance and the paint colors when they were newly erected. The Halliday Standard, the first successful self-governing American windmill. The Eclipse, its major competitor, the classic solid wheel windmill. Isn't it interesting to see the colors that the black and white photography didn't record? The original star made in Kendallville, Indiana. Red, white, and blue. Duplex Vaneless from Superior, Wisconsin. Bright yellow with leaf green. Red castings. the Elgin Vainless from Elgin, Illinois, where the famous Elgin watches were made. Perkins Solid Wheel from Mishawaka, Indiana. The company began as an axe maker. Waupun Vainless from Waupun, Wisconsin. Dempster Vainless from Beatrice, Nebraska. These things were pretty, weren't they? Enterprise from Illinois. Windmill towers themselves present a remarkable range of designs. In the earliest years of windmill use in the mid-19th century, simple towers consisted of one or two vertical timber uprights supported with guy wires to the sides, but they soon proved inadequate, especially on the plains. Much more common became the four-post wooden towers, which were very similar in design to the wooden towers that today remain in use in the region. Built from 4x4-inch, 4x6-inch, or 8x8-inch timbers, combined with appropriately sized but thinner horizontal and diagonal braces, these towers have changed very little over the last century. Wooden towers were assembled on their sides, laying on the ground, and then teams of animals or motor trucks with cables raised them to their vertical position. Oftentimes the windmill was in position already at the apex. In the arid parts of the plains, such wooden derricks can last almost indefinitely. Specialized heavy-duty towers were required for the frequently large diameter windmills for large volume or particularly deep pumping. Termed railroad pattern mills from their frequent use, elevating boiler water for steam locomotives, these mills demanded especially designed derricks that could withstand extreme stresses and strains to which the mills were subjected. As modern travelers on the plains readily observe, only a minority of the present day windmills and towers are built from wood. Rather, the predominant material of construction seen today is steel. As early as the 1870s, all-metal windmills had begun to appear on the marketplace, although the earliest examples gained a well-deserved reputation for weakness and difficulty to repair. Things changed in the 1880s when scientific tests on the efficiency of windwheel design demonstrated that properly curved steel blades secured much greater power from the wind than the thin, flat wooden blades. Although a number of firms began producing all-metal windmills, most of them of steel construction, the movement clearly was led by a new firm in Chicago called the Air Motor Company. Almost all the metal wind machines were of back-geared design, so that approximately 3 revolutions of the wheel produced 1 stroke of the pump. This allowed the newer steel mills to operate in lighter winds and subsequently pump more water than the cumbersome direct-stroke wooden wheel mills. historic photographs that follow are coupled with field photographs of some of the most common among the steel mills. The Steel Eclipse type WG. The Sampson and the Sampson Oil Riot. The Oil Bath Air Motor. Jim Wind Engine. Woodmant Steel. That's in Grant, Nebraska. Don't you wish those boogers were still there? Monitor Steel. Monitor Steel pumped the water for my great-grandparents. Twin Wheel, manufactured in Hutchinson, Kansas. Two big wheels that turn like this. With the all-metal windmills came towers made from steel as well. Most of the steel towers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries were similar in design to those used today. They were made from either three or four angle steel legs to which were added a variety of braces. The bracing generally consisted of light angle steel horizontal members to which were added diagonal braces made from steel straps, steel rods, heavy galvanized wire, and combinations thereof. Steel towers were designed so that they could be either built up from the ground, one piece at a time, or alternately assembled lying on the ground, like the wooden towers had all been, and then raised in one piece after assembly. Among the more unusual tower designs produced during the late 19th century were the tilting towers. Made from either steel or wood, these derricks were hinged at their midpoints so that the owner could release a pin and then, with a rope, pull the hinged portion down for convenient servicing. Perfect for the acrophobic windmill owner. This avoided the frequently dreaded climb to the top of the tower. A major influence on windmill tower design was geography. On the level plains, for example, there were no obstructions to the wind, and in theory, the towers need only to be about 20 feet tall to receive sufficient wind to operate the mills. If a well is located in a naturally low place, like a stream valley, it may be necessary for the tower to extend upward 15 to 20 feet above the surrounding ground level in order to receive enough wind to operate properly. Interesting regional variations in windmill and tower design can be found through careful observation in the field. Frequently, one brand of mill and tower will predominate in a given area, indicating the activity of a particularly successful dealer or agent. In the Corn Belt, particularly tall towers from 40 to 60 feet high seem to be especially common, while in the Platte Valley of Nebraska, with a shallow water table, mills are found on distinctively short, stubby Nebraska spread towers. When a windmill is erected at a farm or ranch headquarters, it's important for the tower to stand at least 15 to 20 feet taller than any nearby obstructions like trees or barns. Although obviously the wheel has to be high enough to catch the wind, it's equally important that the mill stand high enough in the air to avoid dangerous ground turbulence around the obstructions during high winds. The proverbial expression among the windmillers is, the taller the tower, the safer the windmill. Frequently today, one finds windmills surrounded by clumps of trees. When the wells were drilled and the towers erected, the vegetation often didn't exist at all. Over the years, however, the leakage of water around the well has permitted the growth of the trees, which in time may even threaten the windmill and tower that had nourished its growth. So far, we've talked about mass-produced windmills, the ones that came from factories. Now, they represented by far the greatest proportion of the windmills on the plains, but a comparatively small number instead were homemade. And a handful of them even survived today. For many years, Plains residents have perpetuated a tradition of building their own windmills for pumping or mechanical power production, such as the efforts you see here of Canadian farmer Howard Flickinger in Alberta, who built a wind machine using blades made out of barrel staves to churn butter on his farm near Skiff, up in Alberta, about 1915. The wind power literature is filled with references to such machines. Now, so far the windmills we've talked about have had open framework towers, the type that you see in the field today. But not all towers were designed that way. Far to the contrary, an interesting minority of windmill towers on the Great Plains were enclosed to provide sheltered work areas for feed grinders or other small farm machines, or to create well houses with their own cooling troughs for dairy and other products. Most often, these enclosed towers were simple affairs made from sawed lumber, or shingle-covered sides mounted on sawed lumber tower legs, but not always. Occasionally, these enclosed towers were architectural works in themselves designed to ornament the properties on which they stood. John D. Rockefeller even had such a tower, the one you see right here at his country estate outside Cleveland, Ohio, where a Perkins solid wheel windmill pumped the water for the house and grounds. Some of the towers themselves supported overhead water tanks made from either galvanized sheet steel or wooden staves, and by so doing, they provided their users with gravity-fed water systems in which faucets controlled the flow. As you see here, the companies even gave their customers plans for building their own. While some of the windmill users placed their overhead tanks inside their windmill towers as a means for securing convenient gravity-fed water for their homes and barns, just like we've seen, others chose to erect separate structures to support even larger tanks for the same purpose. Most often these were open frameworks, typically built from wood, but sometimes from steel or masonry for especially large tanks. Occasionally they were enclosed with weatherboarding or shingles to create tank houses. From the outset, most consumers on the Great Plains used windmills to pump water. That's what we think about today. A smaller but yet substantial number employed windmills to do other human work. I would like for us to look at the so-called power windmills, machines that our foreparents employed on farms and ranches and in small towns to take the place of human and animal muscle power. Rather than using windmills to produce reciprocating motion to pump water, these wind machines created rotary motion to operate machinery. The mechanisms differed. The spinning motion of the wind wheels on the power windmills was transmitted by way of steel main shafts to beveled gears on their backsides. The teeth on these gears meshed with those on other beveled gears mounted at the tops of vertical steel shafts that extended downward through the supporting towers to the lower level. There, they ended at somewhat similar beveled foot gears that changed the direction of the spinning shafts from vertical to horizontal. From this point, turning shafts supported on appropriate brackets and fitted with bearings and lubricators reached outward to connect to pulleys that connected by belts to drive the desired machinery. In a simple installation, a power windmill might operate just one machine, like a livestock feed grinder. But most owners use the power captured from the wind to drive multiple different types of machines. This meant that the operator might use a feed grinder, a wood saw, or a fodder cutter, all depending upon the work that needed to be done at the time. Because power windmills transmitted motive force to machinery with spinning steel shafts, their makers faced a common design concern. Torque created by the steel shafts in ordinary operation caused the windmills to incline away from the wind. As this occurred, they captured less of its power. Some designers created wind machines with smaller, faster-turning steel power transmission shafts, while others made them heavier and slower-turning to counteract the tendency. Some companies' engineers added sets of beveled gears in the steel shafts below the wind machines, like you see here, to reduce the tendency to creep away from the wind. The majority of the manufacturers, however, relied on the ordinary governing systems to direct the wheels squarely enough into the wind to meet most operating needs. Companies mass-producing power windmills also made the steel shafts, shaft supports, foot gears, and auxiliary goods to complete the installations. These goods included important safety features such as inline safety clutches on the shafts. If a piece of machinery jammed, these devices would release it in order to reduce or avoid damage or injury to operators. Some windmill manufacturers sought to increase the power of their machines by using more than one wheel in their designs. Notable among these firms was the Challenge Windmill and Feed Mill Company of Batavia, Illinois, which as early as 1872 began producing its imposing double-header power windmills. These striking machines employed two large wind wheels comprised of adjustable sections of wooden blades that pivoted in governing to control the wheel speed. The double-header mills also had two additional wheels mounted at right angles to the main driving wheels that served to point the two large wheels into the wind. Although the Challenge Company made these great wind engines until 1899, they're rare today. A fine example recently was restored by the Hardin Foundation in Salinas, California, and they even have a webcam on it. So when it's turned on, you can see it in motion. The Challenge Company also made another wind machine producing rotary power with one large sectional wheel and sometimes two smaller side wheels called the single header. As was the case with pumping mills, all power windmills initially were made with wooden wheels, while iron and steel parts held them together. By the 1870s, the industry began a gradual transition from wood to steel in power mill construction. For a quarter century, the number of wooden windmills did not substantially decrease, but the number of all metal windmills made increased. By the second decade of the 20th century, steel models were the majority of the wind machines of all types made in America. One of the all-metal windmills that came onto the market in the late 1890s was the Cogless Power Mill made by Heller Aller and Company of Napoleon, Ohio. Instead of using bevel gears to make the 90-degree angle between the main shaft of the windmill and the vertical shaft downward, this machine instead employed a universal coupling designed and tested by the company for the very purpose. The Elgin Windmill Company in Elgin, Illinois, made one of the last innovations in power windmill design in the late 1920s, after most of the other windmills for producing rotary power had disappeared from the market. This company developed an oil bath style steel power windmill, the Wonder Power, which is believed to have been the only wind machine produced for driving machinery that operated in a bath of oil and was self-lubricating. Windmills designed to drive machinery frequently were mounted atop the buildings where the owners expected to use the equipment. This meant that the internal framework of barns or outbuildings had to be constructed with sufficient strength to support both the weight of the wind machine and tower and to withstand the stresses and strains that extreme winds could exert. These buildings likewise supported the spinning steel shafts, pulleys, and belts that connected with the feed grinders, corn shellers, and other machinery powered by the windmills. Not all power windmills, however, stood atop buildings. Others were mounted on the tops of conventional four-leg derricks that often were boarded over to protect machinery and operators from the elements. Historic enclosed towers for power windmills to this day remain common elements of the built environment in the prairie provinces in Western Canada. Windmills producing rotary power found as many applications as there were small machines to be operated. Sometimes they found heavier work. Probably the most frequent use was in grinding feed grains for livestock. During the 19th century, many farmers and ranchers in North America believed that grains should be ground and cooked in order to provide their animals with more nutritious feed than eating ordinary unhulled grain. United States Commissioner of Patents Henry Ellsworth promoted the practice, stating that 13 pounds of ground and cooked corn would provide the nutrition of 30 pounds of raw, unground corn. Those who opted not to cook the feed nevertheless often chose to grind it. Because of their interest in the health of their herds and flocks, agriculturists in North America purchased not only windmills providing rotary power, but also feed grinders that came with belts and pulleys to be driven by the wind machines. Their only other options for grinding feed grains during most of the 19th century was to purchase it from commercial mills or from neighbors, to grind it by hand, or to purchase expensive steam engines to power their grinding equipment. Considering these options, it's not a surprise that many farmers and ranchers chose to let the wind do their grinding. And some of the simplest grinders, like this one, were attached to the bases of the rotary shafts near the foot gears, even though there were plenty of larger grinders. Some users of wind power employed truly large wind machines to operate small grist mills to produce flour and meal for human consumption. These wind machines were sometimes 40, 50, and even 60 feet in diameter, standing on derricks that towered over buildings that housed the milling equipment. Among the wind machines that found applications for powering these flour and grist mills were the Halliday and Wheeler's patent and the double header models made respectively by the U.S. Wind Engine and Pump Company and the Challenge Windmill and Feed Mill Company. One of the better known Halliday and Wheeler's patent windmill installations had a 60-foot diameter wheel that powered a flour mill at Bennett, Nebraska in the 1870s. The miller at Bennett on the 8th of March, 1875, wrote the following response. Pardon me. I need to back up one. There we are. He wrote this letter in response to a query from the company about the machine. In answer as to how I like the 60-foot windmill, I will say that it exceeds my most sanguine expectations. I thought it might be possible to run two pairs of stones, but did not think it would run three pair and all the machinery in a moderate wind. A great many have asked if I can make as good flour by wind power. I've worked at milling 18 years in as good a water and steam mills as there are in the country, and I can make as good a flour in this mill as any the same size and capacity that I ever worked in. I consider the windmill a perfect success. Just as there were large applications of the wind for grinding grain, there were also modest uses. Not all farmers or ranchers could afford the luxury of having a windmill devoted to just producing rotary power to operate machinery. Many still wanted to grind livestock feeds for the benefit of their animals. Some of them purchased small ratchet-type feed grinders that were actuated by the reciprocating movement of pump rods on their water-pumping windmills. As the pump rods moved up and down, linkage connected them to the slow-moving feed grinders where a ratchet mechanism drove steel rotary grinding plates inside. These devices sometimes even fastened to the legs of derricks to operate in the open air during dry weather. The most popular of these ratchet feed grinders was a pattern Oswald E. Winger invented in the late 1870s and it remained available commercially at least as recently as 1912. Other clever individuals invented machines called power converters. These devices translated the reciprocating motion created by the pump rods on water-pumping windmills into slow but steady rotary movement. The makers claimed the power converters could run any machines that a power windmill could drive, but in reality, their much slower operating speeds meant that they didn't work fast enough for a lot of the machinery. Many farmers and stock raisers used wind power to cut fodder, turnips, and other crops. Most of the windmill manufacturers of these power windmills also produced lines of equipment to shred these animal feeds, sometimes also making elevators that move the prepared fodder into raised containers. Some of these cutters had special attachments designed for processing the stalks of corn plants. American farmers typically allowed their corn to dry on the cob, necessitating means for removing the hard kernels. Some farmers used machines called corn shellers, in which rotating abrasive discs scraped the dry kernels from the cobs. Because corn was a major feed grain on the Great Plains, almost every farm had at least simple hand-operated corn shellers. To reduce human labor on larger farms, operators occasionally purchased shellers having broad drive wheels that could be turned by belts run by the power windmills. Churning butter from milk represented another repetitive chore that rural dwellers sought to lighten through the use of the wind. Rotary power made available by power windmills was easily applied to churns fitted with drive wheels. Some people even adapted the reciprocating motion of pumping wind machines to actuate dashers in conventional churns, while others even created linkages from their wind machines to tumble rotary churns designed to be turned by hand. among the jobs constituting the greatest drudgery for boys growing up on farms and ranches was sawing firewood for heating and cooking. In the northern United States, individual homes required considerable stocks of sawed lumber to feed the insatiable stoves, fireplaces, and kitchen ranges. Not only did male members of the households or paid laborers have to cut down the trees and haul them to the farm or ranch headquarters, but then they had to cut it into lengths that would fit into the stoves and fireplaces. Many rural dwellers purchased special circular saws mounted on metal or wooden frames that connected with leather belts to spinning rotary shafts driven by power windmills. In this way, they could at least saw the wood into usable lengths. E.A. Atwater used one of these saws on his Minnesota farm and described its use this way. "Three of us together bought one of your saws, and they bring their wood here and saw it with my mill. We saw sticks so big that a saw will not reach through and have to roll the stick over and cut the other side. And for all of this, it has only cost us 85 cents for repairs." Much of the work performed by windmills was indeed drudgery. This certainly was true of the multiple applications of the wind in washing clothes. Operators of 19th century washing machines pushed and pulled the ends of lever-like handles that actuated the agitators inside. Clever homemakers or their family members sometimes connected these levers to the pump rods of conventional windmills or to the drive mechanisms of windmills producing rotary power. In an unexpected similar application, members of the American Armed Forces on Pacific Islands during World War II built their own simple wind machines to operate simple plunger-type washing machines inside 55-gallon steel drums. Some users of wind power chose to purchase only wind machines designed to produce rotary power. This was fine so long as until they needed to pump water, since most power windmills were not designed to operate piston pumps. Consequently, the makers of these machines marketed adapters that mounted on the outside of the derricks to convert rotary motion into up and down reciprocating pump strokes. Sometimes the wells were directly under the towers, but frequently they were to one side in order to be out of the way of the work with the feed grinders and other machines inside. This meant that the reciprocating pump strokes were transmitted to the outside in order to actuate the pumps. Mallon B. Moyer installed an auxiliary pump with his 12-foot power air motor at the turn of the 20th century, and he wrote this about it. "My two boys both declared that they would no longer work for me as long as they had to pump this water for the cattle, and they clipped off to the ironworks." This wasn't the end of his problems. "I then had to get a hired man, and he scolded and said he would not stay." Finally, Moyer bought the wind-powered equipment, and he could report with relief, "My two sons are so well pleased that they now say it's fun to be on the farm, and I have no trouble to get my work done." Occasionally, wind power users chose to move the windmill to the work site rather than to take the work to the wind machine. Consequently, they devised interesting portable wind machines that could be transported to the location where they needed to perform the tasks. Windmills producing rotary power found applications doing many different types of work, some of them unexpected. In some instances, they provided the motive force to operate machine and tool shops, as in the instance of a small tool factory adapted to wind power by Henry F. Glover in Napoli, New York, about 1890, or the machine shop run by Joseph Venduska at Pilsen, Kansas, a decade later. At least one American quarry in the late 19th century used a power air motor windmill to operate stone cutting saws, though an engine was kept as a backup for when the wind didn't blow. Ore crushing, hard work under any circumstances, provided unexpected applications for wind machines. In a notable instance, a manufacturer in New York State exported seven 36-foot diameter wind machines to the island of Aruba in the Caribbean Sea, specifically for use in ore reduction. Windmills operating farm machines remained available commercially until the third decade in the 20th century, but by this time they were already obsolete. The development of comparatively inexpensive small internal combustion engines in the 1890s began a trend that resulted in the replacement of power windmills with small engines that burn petroleum-based fossil fuels. Once gas engines became common on farms, there was no way that rotary power producing wind machines could compete with them. And they disappeared from the market, although water pumpers continued in service to the very day. Despite the hard lessons in economics, some people preferred to use the renewable power of the wind to perform human work. John Breen of Holland, Wisconsin, expressed these feelings in a letter he wrote in 1892, describing the work performed by his Eclipse power windmill. "It's now grinding all the feed for 6 horses, 24 head of cattle and hogs, shells all the corn, does all the pumping for the stock, saws all our wood, runs a wooden turn lathe and grindstone. It does all the churning every day. It runs a washing machine, and not the least, runs a crank pipe organ so the girls can have a song and dance while the machine is doing their work." Throughout the Great Plains, the use of wind power made its marks on the land. Some of these are better seen from the air than from the ground. These traces take the form of shallow earthen reservoirs. In ranch country, these reservoirs, termed tanks in vernacular speech, consist merely of low earthen dams across natural drainage channels. They fill with water either from precipitation or pumped from the ground by windmills. In farming country, however, these reservoirs, usually built above ground level and most frequently rectangular, held water pumped by windmills, often for small-scale irrigation. Windmill irrigation held the attention of farmers in many localities on the Great Plains, particularly in the decade of the 1890s. And to this day, remnants of the shallow earthen reservoirs still dot the landscape. The legacy of the windmills on the Great Plains remains not only on the land, but also in the hearts and the spirits of the people who've lived there. Their impact today may be evocative. But in the past, these machines and the structures that supported them became integral with the way people lived their lives. This bonding of windmills with individuals can be seen in extracts from the diaries of cowboy William W. Tanner, a Texan who became a homesteader in the Oklahoma Territory, but that didn't keep him from working for cash as a cowboy on the XIT ranch in the Texas Panhandle while he was proving up his claim in Oklahoma Territory. May 20th, 04. Now sitting on a windmill tower in the Black Muley pasture, can see the Rabbit Ears Mountains in New Mexico, making a 5-mile ride to see my girl. Saturday, May 21st, 04. Sitting on top of windmill number 53, 15 miles from ranch, but riding a good old XIT horse, which makes it only 3/4 of an hour's ride in. Saturday, evening, May 28th, 04. Now in the east side of El Frio pasture, repairing windmills. A lonesome Saturday evening, you bet. Can see 15 miles in any direction and can see nothing but a black muley steer and a couple of antelopes grazing most a mile away. Will now cook, eat, and go to sleep. Sunday morning, May 29th, 04. Another Sunday that seems like any other day in this God-forsaken country. June 10th, 04. All alone in camp. Am now sitting on top of windmill tower watching cattle come in to drink. Only 14 head of mine have come in so far. June 29th, 04. Sitting on top of windmill tower watching an old Fort Worth in Denver train go toward Fort Worth. Wish it was taking me. Thank you very much.